The History of Literature podcast is a member of the Podglomerate Network and Lit Hub Radio. Hello, it was one of those fortuitous moments, a happy podcasting accident. I was going through an obsession with Thomas Hardy and his poetry, and an email came in. Yes, I would love to return to the program to talk about my new novel, said super guest Margot Livesey. And what else should we talk about, Jack? Maybe mistakes in Thomas Hardy? Yes, please. Mistakes in Hardy, Margot Livesey and her new novel, and the love poetry of a man in his 70s, looking back at the lost love and lost life of his first wife, Emma. All that coming up today on the History of Literature. Okay, here we go. Welcome to the podcast, everyone. I'm Jack Wilson. I'm so glad you're here today for episode 601. Off to the races, aren't we? So many good things to share with you. I went to see Margot give a reading here in Washington, D.C. We recorded this interview before that, though, so I don't mention it, but it was a wonderful night. With an excellent reading and then a Q&A with novelist Alice McDermott doing the hosting honors. The two of them in front of a crowd. It was a big success. I was glad I could attend. And I'm glad to be able to give you a dose of that night, some captured magic, in the form of a conversation with Margot. She's not just a novelist, she's a reader. And for this novel in particular, as she will explain, she's been diving into the world of Thomas Hardy. Hardy the novelist is hard to beat, no pun intended. He's been popular for a century and a half, and for good reason. His characters feel so real, and the situations they're in are deftly described. He feels more modern than many of his contemporaries, more 20th century than 19th, thanks to his frankness about human beings and human sexual desires in particular. Not all critics were fans, however. Here's a review of Far From the Madding Crowd. Quote, "Everything human in the book strikes us as factitious and insubstantial. The only things we believe in are the sheep and the dogs," end quote. Well, who cares what one reviewer thinks? What does he know about writing novels? Let's see. Who was that? Oh, yes. Oh, okay. It was by some guy named Henry James. He'll never amount to much. Imagine being Hardy and getting a review like that from Henry James. An optimist might say, hey, James loves my sheep and my dogs. I don't know what Hardy made of that review. The James review is kind of a wonder. He says Hardy goes on too long and elaborates too much. From Henry James. James's take on the book, Far From the Madding Crowd, seems to have suffered from some overhype. Someone said, hey, this new novel it's on a par with George Eliot. And so James's hopes were high, but although he found the book clever, he did not think that Hardy was on the same level as George Eliot. Well, who among us? Who among us, Mr. James? Listen to this paragraph, quote, this is from the review, quote, Mr. Hardy puts his figures through a variety of comical movements. He fills their mouths with quaint turns of speech. He baptizes them with odd names. Joseph Poorgrass, for a bashful, easily snubbed dissenter, is excellent. He pulls the wires in short and produces a vast deal of sound and commotion, and his novel, at a cursory glance, has a rather promising air of life and warmth. But it has a fatal lack of magic. We have found it hard to read, but its shortcomings are easier to summarize than to encounter in order. Mr. Hardy's novel is very long, but his subject is very short and simple, and the work has been distended to its rather formidable dimensions by the infusion of a large amount of conversational and descriptive padding, and the use of an ingeniously verbose and redundant style. It is inordinately diffuse, and as a piece of narrative, singularly inartistic. The author has little sense of proportion and almost none of composition, end quote. Well, other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, But I do wonder, as I read this, if James is seeing a bit of himself in Mr. Hardy. Comical movements, quaint turns of speech, odd names. This is the author who named a character Casper Goodwood. An ingeniously verbose and redundant style. Inordinately diffuse. Physician, it might be too late to heal thyself. Call thyself a mortician. But let's put that aside for now, because we will have much more about Hardy without the distraction of that hater, Henry James. Margot Livesey is going to tell us about Hardy the novelist, as she, herself a novelist, discovered this time around. And I will have much more about Hardy the poet. But first, before we get to the conversation that I had with Margot, let me give you a taste of Hardy's poetry. This is his poem called The Voice, written in his early 70s after his first wife, Emma, had died. Hardy and his wife, Emma, had been estranged for some time. I'll have the full story in our conversation with Margot. But for now, just think about an older man looking back on the passage of decades and then the loss of an early love and him reflecting on what it all means. The Voice, published in 1914. Woman much missed, how you call to me, saying that now you are not as you were, when you had changed from the one who was all to me, but as at first, when our day was fair. Can it be you that I hear? Let me view you, then, standing as when I drew near to the town, where you would wait for me. Yes, as I knew you then, even to the original air-blue gown. Or is it only the breeze in its listlessness, traveling across the wet mead to me here, you being ever dissolved to wan wistlessness, heard no more again, far or near? Thus I, faltering forward, leaves around me falling, wind oozing thin through the thorn from norward, and the woman calling. Let's unpack this a bit. There's beautiful repetition in the first line. Woman much missed, how you call to me. Can you hear the longing in there? There's wistfulness. There's kind of there's a haunting in that repetition. Imagine a line he could have written, something like, woman much missed, how you call to me, repeatedly. That almost works rhythmically. It would give us the rhyme. But so much better to just lean on the repetition and say, woman much missed, how you call to me. The urgency of that, the slight desperation, saying that now you are not as you were. That's a great line too, the second line. The woman has died, so it's a ghost who's doing the calling. I'm a spirit now, not flesh and blood, but it's also the passage of time that she's saying. I'm an older woman, like you're an older man, but in our memories we were young and in love in our 20s. That's the woman who calls to him, saying that she is not as she was. And it goes on, when you had changed from the one who was all to me. Love that rhyme. Simple. Call to me, all to me. These are simple words. Later we'll have another rhyme will be, let me view you then and as I knew you then. Right? Simple words told simply, presented without affect. It's a kind of a guileless poem in some ways. Sometimes Hardy's not like that, but here he is. But as at first, when our day was fair, we were young ones, saying, second stanza introduces some doubt. He's scanning his memory. Can it be you that I hear? Let me view you then. Standing as when I drew near to the town, where you would wait for me. Yes, as I knew you then. Even to the original air blue gown. An air blue gown. Can you picture that? Can you picture the color of air blue, but also wouldn't that be what a spirit might wear? Right? In this air blue gown? And is this truly a woman calling or something more like a ghost or more like the wind? Can it be you that I hear? He's not sure, is he? But, and we get this in the very next stanza. Or is it only the breeze in its listlessness? Traveling across the wet mead to me here, you being ever dissolved to wan wistlessness, heard no more again, far or near? The woman is gone. She's dissolved to wan wistlessness. Hardy's first shot at this was existlessness. You being ever dissolved to existlessness. But that's way too on the nose, right? Wan, W-A-N, wan wistlessness captures the feeling of loss perfectly. She's been dissolved. Her body is gone. Even her voice is heard no more again. Not from a remote place like the grave or heaven, but also not near. Not far, not near? I can't hear you from a distance, and you're not right in my ear. You're not close either. Or are you? The breeze travels listlessly across the wet mead. Not with purpose. Not directly. It floats in. It might be your voice calling to me, calling to me. Or maybe it's just a bit of wan wistlessness. Ah. As if the voice is, it's not direct. It's not saying, hey, Thomas, here I am. It's just maybe. It's all maybe. Maybe I hear you. It's an aching poem. It's so beautiful. And how does it end? With the man who feels this contradiction, the man in his 70s looking back on his life, on his love, which was shattered. More on that later. And how this contradiction lives within him now. The wind might contain her voice or it might not. But for him, either way, it almost doesn't matter. His thought that it sounds like her voice is what matters and that he can't tell. The final stanza, thus I, faltering forward, leaves around me falling, wind oozing thin through the thorn from norward, and the woman calling. I often don't like poems that rhyme, but the rhymes here, spot on. Faltering forward, the thorn from norward, and leaves around me falling, and the woman calling. Faltering forward, that's what he'll have from now on, as the leaves fall this autumn and as the north wind oozes thin through the thorn, rattling the bushes or maybe just whispering its way through the bushes, he'll have the woman calling. That's what he hears. It's like when you put the seashell to your ear and you hear the ocean, kind of, maybe, definitely, not quite definitely. It's there. You hear it, you don't. That's what the wind will be for him. It's her voice on the wind calling, calling. It's a beautiful, haunting poem. Haunting or haunted? You might call it haunted. I'll choose haunting. Margot Livesey with more on Thomas Hardy after this. Hey, grown-ups, the Cat in the Hat cast is a new podcast from Wondery, perfect for the whole family. Join the Cat in the Hat and your favorite Dr. Seuss characters as they get whisked away on a new adventure every week. Fish dreams of creating his very own polite and quiet podcast. That is, until he gets a surprise visit to his Fishbowl podcast studio from the Cat in the Hat himself, and it becomes very clear that the cat has other plans for the podcast, and those plans are the opposite of quiet. The cat may be disruptive, but it turns out he's also a great help to get Fish out of all kinds of predicaments. Bursting with music, silliness, and rhymes, The Cat in the Hat cast encourages us all to find fun that is funny in every episode. Sing along to new favorite songs, try your luck at Titanic tongue twisters, have some fun with wondrous wordplay, and most importantly, bring your family along for all of the adventures in the Cat in the Hat cast. Follow the Cat in the Hat cast on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to the Cat in the Hat cast ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. Hello, everyone. This is Jack here to tell you about a way to eat better and easier. That's right, Factor, and their delicious, ready-to-eat meals. These things are amazing, chef-crafted, always fresh, never frozen. All you do is heat them up and you're ready to go. No prepping, cooking, or cleanup. And you get something healthy, nutritious, and tasty. I love Factor meals, especially on those days when I'm in the office. They're better for me than snacks or junk food, and much cheaper and faster than buying my lunch at a restaurant. You can choose options like Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, Keto, and you can change your schedule to get as much or as little as you need every week. Whatever suits you and your family best. Head to factormeals.com/literature50 and use code literature50 to get 50% off. That's code literature50 at factormeals.com/literature50 to get 50% off. Okay, we're joined now by one of our favorite guests here at the History of Literature podcast, Margot Livesey, novelist and teacher of creative writing. She joins us from the tour of her 9th novel, I think I have that right, The Road from Belhaven, which takes the reader into 19th century Scotland. Margot Livesey, welcome back to the History of Literature.
Thank you so much, Jack. I am honored to be here once again.
So I thought we'd go, in a way this feels backwards to me, but I thought we would start with the tour you're on and then talk about the novel and then Thomas Hardy. So what is a tour like for a novelist these days? How many cities, and are you going to bookstores? Are you doing this all by yourself? Do you go to libraries and book clubs? I'm interested in all of it. Things have changed so much in the publishing industry.
You're completely right. I think every time one publishes a novel, one's, or a book, one's publishing into a new world.
Yeah.
And now we're publishing into a post-COVID world. Mm, so for my last novel, The Boy in the Field, I did everything on Zoom. And it's really lovely to be going back into bookshops and meeting booksellers and readers and, you know, opinionated people. I'm so happy to be doing that. My tour is, I would say, a sort of modest and slightly disorganized one.
Mm-hmm.
I've organized some events around Boston, around Chicago, and my lovely publisher, Knopf, has organized some events in California and Miami and DC and New York. So putting the two together, it looks quite busy, but then quite a lot of it is me getting into my hybrid and driving somewhere.
So not as glamorous as one might think.
It's not as glamorous as one might think, but very rewarding in meeting readers, which is, you know, after 3 years alone in a room, I'm very happy to get out and meet readers.
Right. I always feel a little bit with authors, especially authors who are reluctant to come onto the podcast. And I think, but you will go to a library and talk to 25 or 30 people. And we have, you know, many multiples of that that you can reach in just a, you know, with the, from the comfort of your own home. But I think authors, they get something out of that in-person experience that I just can't replicate with the podcast.
Well, that may be some authors, but for me, you absolutely replicate the experience of being in the presence of readers. I
guess
love
that's
talking
right. Yeah,
to you.
That's right. I guess I have to stand in for whatever crowd that you might be talking to. And do you feel like if the turnout that there is a kind of multiplying effect that everybody you talk to is maybe somebody who's going to get the book, but they'll also recommend the experience to their friends. And it seems like even if the crowd is not that big, you can feel like it's still worth your time.
You know, I really try to be, this sounds, I don't know, maybe too new agey, but I really try to be in the present for these events and just to welcome whoever is there. I mean, and, I try not to think in terms of numbers or quantifying everything, though, of course, that's how my publisher thinks. I just try to think of the experience of talking to each person and their relationship, you know, to books and reading and what brings them there.
Mm-hmm. It is a real honor in that sense that someone will, you know, there's so many rivals for people's attention and interest that someone who will take the time out to come to a bookstore or a library and sit in the presence of an author and hear what he or she has to say, it really is something to be grateful for.
I would completely agree with that. I mean, I think authors nowadays, we're like the ancient mariner in Coleridge's poem, you know, we're sort of begging the wedding guests to stop and listen to us. And there's a lot of competition for attention.
Right.
So yes, I feel so lucky when people show up to hear me.
Right. Well, this would be a nice transition to Thomas Hardy, but instead I want to hear about your novel first. So tell us about The Road from Belhaven.
The Road from Belhaven is about Lizzie Craig, who is born in the Kingdom of Fife in Scotland and in the 1870s. And we follow her really from the age of 10 to the age of 20. So it's a coming-of-age novel, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very loosely based on my great-grandmother, Lizzie Craig, and my fairly recent discovery of her relationship with the supernatural, that she had second sight. She could see the future, but she could never change it. And I was so interested in hearing several of her descendants report that and tell me stories about her that I started to write this novel during COVID when I couldn't go to Scotland as a way of going to Scotland every day.
Mm. Right. Now, who were the descendants? Were these people that you knew well? Was it your own mother or grandmother, for example?
No, actually the reverse. From the age of 22, by which time both my father and my mother were dead, to well into my 60s, I believed I had no living relatives.
Oh, wow.
And then a former student was working on my family tree on Ancestry.com. And a woman wrote to her saying, "Did Eva McEwen have a living child?" And I wrote back and said, "She did, and I am that child." And it turned out, contrary to my understanding, that I had many relatives. They just all happened to be in Australia.
Wow.
So I heard the stories about my great-grandmother, Lizzie Craig, when I went to Brisbane to meet them.
Right. Wow, what an interesting, you know, it's almost like you kind of come full circle, that you who knew Scotland so well go to Australia, but those people knew your ancestor in Scotland so well, and you were able to kind of combine the two as you heard these stories.
Yeah, no, there was something about that trip that I found very completely fascinating. And I will confess that I did not for a moment think of writing about the material until COVID came.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, I kept thinking about my mother, Eva, whom I'd written about in Eva Moves the Furniture, and how she had a relationship with the supernatural. And so suddenly it seemed irresistible to write about my great-grandmother and her relationship with second sight.
Mm. Do you have a position or a set of beliefs about the supernatural? And I'll tell you just where I'm coming from on this. I would be the sort of person who would be very skeptical. And whenever I hear stories like that, I'm always thinking, oh, it's probably a trick or a mistake or some kind of misunderstanding, except that when it's in my own family and when it's happened to me, that I feel like I know with certainty that there is something there that I couldn't explain if I limited myself to the natural.
I completely share your opinion, Jack. I feel so skeptical about people who see Elvis at the supermarket. and at the same time, the stories in my own family about Eva, about Lizzie, I am completely credulous about them. And the oldest members of my Australian family gave me one very striking example of Lizzie's second sight, which was that in something like 1938-39, she predicted that Japan would enter the Second World War on the side of Germany. This was well before Pearl Harbor, and not something anyone would have predicted.
Right. Wow. Okay. And then how did that turn into a novel? How did you decide to limit yourself to age 10 to 20, for example?
Yeah. How did I? I decided that, you know, a couple of things I was really interested in were that the second half of the 19th century in both Britain and America were the great age of industrialization. And people could at last, if they chose, leave the countryside to move to the city and earn some money, maybe not very much money, but they had choices they really hadn't had previously. So that was very interesting to me. And I was also very interested in writing about that moment when, you know, I think as a child, you know so much and your life is so passionate and so intelligent, but you never guess that beneath their respectable outward appearances, the adults around you are governed by secret passions that you don't understand yet. So I was interested in that moment when Lizzie crosses into understanding that there is this thing, sexual attraction, and she is subject to it, if you will. And interestingly, or interestingly to me, although I make her a passionate reader and a great reader, I decided she couldn't read Thomas Hardy, because if she read Thomas Hardy, she would learn about sexual passion from a book rather from rather than from life.
Yeah, I was going to say, 1870s, you are really in one of Hardy's great periods there, at least sort of the, I think he kind of had two phases in the 1870s and 1880s, as far as his novels go. That would have given the game away, so to speak.
Exactly. And I wanted to write about what it was like to have this gift where you could see the future, sometimes in almost tedious ways, if you will. You could see someone losing a hat, say, but sometimes in much more profound ways, but you could never change it, and what that was like to get these messages, as it were. And I thought that was such an interesting conflict for a character to have.
Okay, well, let's take a quick break, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about Thomas Hardy and how and whether you used him to get your creative juices flowing to put yourself in this time frame. Okay, we're back. So, Margot, I kind of teed up the question for you before the break there, but I'm wondering, you had brought up Thomas Hardy when we talked about what we were going to talk about today. And were you reading those novels as part of your dive into the 19th century?
Very much so. I started rereading Hardy the first time I had COVID and kept reading him the second time I had COVID. And I was just so fascinated by what a pioneer he is in in writing about sexual attraction and in about the difficulties of marriage and how marriages are often not as successful as those in Jane Austen, for example.
Right.
And I was also really fascinated in his belief in the power that mistakes have to shape our lives and how many of his characters, their lives are tragically altered by mistakes.
You had mentioned mistakes in Hardy's novels as one of the things we could talk about. And I suspected that you meant mistakes made by the characters. I was kind of hoping you meant mistakes made by Hardy. And we could take some shots at a giant here. But instead, it's mistakes made by characters. And I have a lot that I'm going to talk about in a little bit here about his poetry and his love poetry. But what is it about the mistakes that you saw in the novel? And I guess in one sense, it gives kind of a worldview and a view of life and a way of talking about character. But did you also see mistakes as animating the plot, for example?
I think mistakes are often at the heart of his plots. I mean, speaking of one of his later novels, perhaps the most celebrated nowadays, Tess of the D'Urbervilles, I mean, that crucial moment when Tess decides she must confess everything about her past life to her fiancé, Angel Clare, and she writes him a letter and slips it under his door, and then is delighted the next day when there's no difference in his behavior towards her after reading the letter, only to discover on their wedding day that he has never received it and that the letter has gone not just under the door but under the carpet.
Right.
And that, for me, is such a quintessential Hardy moment. She thinks she's done one thing and actually she's done another. And there's a very similar example in The Wonderful Return of the Native, when Eustacia Vye thinks that her husband, Clem, is going to answer the door to his estranged mother. Clem is asleep, but she's sure his mother's knocking will wake him up. And she hears him saying the word mother, but later it turns out Clem is talking in his sleep and his mother has gone away, the door unopened, and is convinced her son is rejecting her yet again.
Right.
And then ends up dying after an adder bites her on the heath.
Right. It seems so sophisticated in a way, and also maybe riskier for the novelist to use mistakes as a way of pushing things forward like that. I guess the reason why is a simpler way is to have your main character be full of agency and to set up a lot of obstacles and have them overcome those obstacles. But to have things being driven by mistake, it feels like you're, on the one hand, you're excusing things because everyone is acting according to their best knowledge and their best ideas at the time, but also kind of giving them, it's setting them up for this tragedy that maybe isn't necessarily their fault, but it just feels like it's giving the reader a kind of experience that they might not be getting if they're used to reading quest novels, for example, or, you know, novels about heroes.
I think it's a very troubling experience to read Hardy. I mean, he uses the word hap, H-A-P, to mean chance. And I often feel his novels are haphazard, in a certain profound way, that characters are going along doing their best or even sometimes doing their worst and something intervenes and derails them.
Mm, right. Now, I've always seen Hardy as a bridge from the Victorian to the modern, except I also see D.H. Lawrence as occupying that space. And I know you've seen a connection between the two. Is it that they're both bridging, or maybe is Lawrence kind of picking up where Hardy left off? Maybe it's a half a bridge and Lawrence is the second half? Or how do you think we got from the novels of Dickens or George Eliot to the novels that we started getting with the modernists?
I think there are several factors in both their cases. And one is that both of them felt outside the privilege of the British class structure at that time. Mm-hmm. I mean, Hardy apparently hated spending time in London because he always felt socially inferior. He was an architect by trade. And D.H. Lawrence, the son of a miner, had the same experience of being very, very critical of the British aristocracy and their snobbishness and elitishness. And I think that, combined with their interest in the way that sexual passion was one of the ways that class lines got broken down, makes them kindred spirits. Certainly, Lawrence wrote a study of Hardy in 1914, at which point, you know, Hardy didn't die till 1928, so he was writing about one of his contemporaries, although at that time Hardy had stopped writing novels and was writing poetry, I think.
Right.
But I think both of them took on this project of trying to break down those kind of expectations, and it's no accident, I think, that we get Jude the Obscure peering through the gates of what I believe is Oxford, longing to get in and feeling he will never get into Oxford.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay, so that takes me to Hardy's love poetry. As you mentioned, I think it was for the last 38 years of his life, he only wrote poems. But I guess before I get started with my little story here, I was wondering, Hardy, he always wanted to write poetry. He believed in poetry. That was his first love. He thought his poems would last while his novels wouldn't. He said, what made poetry 2,000 years ago makes poetry now. And he thought he could get at what was more enduring and more permanent than he could get at with his novels. But he did want his novels to be poetic. Increasingly, he tried to make them so. Do you feel that when you're reading Hardy's novels, that he is in some sense, even beyond just the prose, but maybe in the structure or the way he uses themes or something, does it feel like he's turning the novel into poetry?
I think that's a wonderful insight, Jack. I was really struck. I went back and read one of his earliest novels, A Pair of Blue Eyes, which is interestingly the novel that introduced the word cliffhanger into the language. You know, someone actually falls over a cliff and
is gripping the side,
and is gripping the side of it as we desperately watch page after page. And then I sort of looked at Return of the Native and Far from the Madding Crowd, and then I went back to Tess of the D'Urbervilles. And I think Hardy, in his great Wessex novels, as he called them, you know, he wrote many of them as serials, and then putting them into books, he often had a chance to revise them and look at them again. But I think in Tess, he finally mastered the art of using landscape to create poetic atmosphere. Mm-hmm. He had been aspiring to that in Return of the Native with Egdon Moore, but I think he finally, but the Egdon Moore is very unvarying, and I think in Tess he finally manages to master the poetry and atmosphere of landscape in a way that when we finally get to Tess sleeping at Stonehenge before she's arrested, I mean, it's such a magnificent moment for literature and for poetry.
Yeah. Okay. So let me tell you about what I had learned. I went down sort of a rabbit hole of Hardy's love poetry in particular, because there were a couple of questions that I wanted answered in my mind. And one of them was why he stopped writing novels and why he switched to poetry for so long. And the other is why he suddenly started writing so many poems about his first wife, Emma. And he wrote one poem about her that he published during her lifetime. And he wrote over 100 after she died. He's been accused of a sort of poetic necrophilia, because he seemed like he could write about people after they had died. But here's what I found. as I mentioned, poetry was his first love. His father had been a musician, which may have given him some feeling for the musicality of prose. But his mother had grown up poor, but she valued education. And Hardy just became, in his teens, a poetry fanatic. He would get up at 4 a.m. to teach himself Latin verse. And then he worked for an architect in his early 20s, but he would stay up past midnight reading and writing poems. And then in those years, he sent his poems off to the publisher or to the literary journals, and they were all rejected, universally rejected. So this convinced him that the editors didn't know what real poetry was and they had no taste. So he started writing novels and he found success. He made money with them. And he married Emma during this period, and she supported his writing novels, and she was a great help to him. But then he became a literary celebrity, and the social circles, which involved a lot of ladies, wanted him to come and visit and give talks and so on. And the success apparently kind of went to his head, and he became this notorious flirt. And he does not sound like he was a very good husband. He began to look elsewhere. And Emma, on the other hand, some say that she had some mental health issues and she had some alcoholism in her family. And it's a bit in dispute among biographers what kind of state she was in. I think she has a lot of defenders now who think that a lot of this was a response to Hardy. After he had become famous for these novels, they moved to the countryside to a house that Hardy's father and brother built for him. And he installed Emma in these upstairs rooms. And they hardly ever saw each other. And he had then his secretary, Florence, who was 39 years younger than him, moved into the lower quarters with Hardy. They met when Hardy was 64. And he told everyone that Florence was living there because she and Emma were friends. But the truth was, they rarely saw Emma. They were just leading these separate lives under the same roof, but on different levels. And Florence would report that she would see Emma sometimes and that Emma was, quote, queerer than ever. And at the time, there was this famous wife murderer in the news, this guy named Dr. Crippen. And Florence,
oh, yes, Crippen, yes. Yeah.
So Florence said, Emma asked me if I've ever noticed how much Hardy physically resembles Crippen. And then she added darkly that she would not be surprised if she ended up under the cellar someday. So, and I've looked at pictures of Crippen and Hardy, and they look just alike. They have a strong resemblance to each other, but there's no suggestion that Hardy was planning to kill Emma or anything like that. And like I said, defenders of Hardy will say that Emma was erratic and she had mental illness in her family, but defenders of her say that all that's overblown and Hardy was cruel. And Florence said that she and Hardy were a genuine love match and that Hardy was one of the kindest, most humane men in the world, and she always loved him. So it's not exactly clear what was happening. But anyway, Emma grew sick, and Hardy seemed not to even know that how sick she was. And then one day, her nurse came downstairs, completely distraught, and said that Emma needed help. And Hardy's first response was to tell the nurse to straighten her collar, that her collar was askew and that she should straighten it. And then he finally got around to wandering upstairs to see what was the matter with Emma. And Emma was in a severe condition, and she died in Hardy's arms.
Oh, my goodness.
And that transformed him, that experience. Mm. And first he looked at her papers. And one of them was called The Pleasures of Heaven and the Pains of Hell. And another of her papers, she had written an essay called What I Think of My Husband.
And oh, I'd love to read that.
Well, Hardy, you can't, because Hardy read them and then he promptly burned them. So they don't exist. All we have are the titles. But at that point, the floodgates opened, and he said that experience made the old brain vocal. And like I said, prior to that, he had published one poem about Emma. It was called Diddy. And after this experience, he wrote a 21 poem sequence about her and more than 100 other poems all about Emma. And it seems that it wasn't until her death that he could feel his emotions about her. And now they were mixed with joy and love, but also grief and remorse and regret and nostalgia. And he would write over and over about this single week when they met. He could remember the tiniest details from 40 years earlier of what had happened with them, his emotions and everything. And there's one poem that we have some different versions of that kind of show his obsession with this and his feelings about it. The poem starts, "Here too I come to interview a ghost," where he's talking about Emma. But then in a later version, that changes to, "I come to interview a voiceless ghost."
Where
she can't talk back. And then in the third version, the final one, he says, "Here too I come to view a voiceless ghost." As if she's just beyond his reach. He can't interview her.
Yes.
He can only... see her, but he can't stop. He can't stop himself. And he wrote so much about Emma that Florence became kind of unnerved. And she wrote at one point, "It seems to me that I am an utter failure if my husband can publish such a sad, sad book." Because so much of it was about Hardy's grief for her. And then, first, I know today we kind of think of Hardy as a novelist and we kind of think he was wrong to think that his poetry would last longer than his novels because his novels are still so celebrated. But he has been very influential and Philip Larkin had said a spinal cord of thought runs through all of Hardy's poetry. And Auden said there's no way to bridge poetic development between Tennyson and T.S. Eliot without including Hardy. Robert Frost was a big fan. He's just, his language, there's a phrase I love. He talks about the moon with these green clouds passing it, and he says, "It's like a drifting dolphin's eye seen through a lapping wave."
Oh, how beautiful.
Yeah, he's a wonderful poet. I wouldn't say they're my favorite poems because it does feel like he's this poet sort of caught in a transition. But I do agree that the thought that comes out of it and the ideas that you get when you spend time with them are, I mean, it's almost like Dickinson or some of my favorite other cerebral poets who you're just overwhelmed by the turns of mind and the intelligence that runs through his poetry. But there is also a kind of bleakness, and I'll end with Florence, who had this great line. Hardy used to go out like every New Year's Eve. He would wander out with his pencil to write a poem, and it was really a sign for him of feeling good that when he was writing poetry, that it was his best states of mind were when he was free to write his poetry. And Florence said he's writing poetry again, which is always a sign of well-being with him. And then she added, "Needless to say, it is an intensely dismal poem."
Perfect.
Yeah. There's my little rabbit hole of Hardy's love poetry and just the strange circumstances that seems to have inspired so much of it.
I knew bits and pieces of this, but I've never heard it put together into a narrative. That is absolutely fascinating. At the risk of trying your patience, could I just offer one small correction about the novel writing? Because there may be some writers listening.
Yeah.
But his first novel was rejected by everyone. He published his next two novels anonymously. The first of them was called Desperate Remedies. He published it in 1871. And his publisher lost £15 on the book and called it a desperate remedy for an emaciated purse. So novelistic success did not come instantly or easily to Hardy.
Right.
It was hard won.
Yeah, it's interesting that he kept going. It was because he does seem to have something about the experience or about the publishing world or about his own sense of himself as a novelist must have told him that it was going to be more lucrative because he always loved poetry better, but he clearly believed that his novels would be more successful.
Yeah. And maybe he knew the story of the Bronte sisters, who famously Charlotte Bronte organized herself, Emily and Anne, to publish a volume of poems to raise money. And they printed 1,000 copies of the book and I think sold one copy. And it was after that that Charlotte said, okay, now we're going to try novel writing. And they all turned to novel writing instead.
Right, right. Well, it worked out in a sense. I mean, Ezra Pound said that Hardy distilled everything in his novels into his poetry. And he said the poems were the harvest of all of his novels.
Oh, what a lovely way of putting it. Yes.
Yeah, something about that experience and about maybe it allowed him to get a lot of his ideas and realism out of his system and say what he wanted to say. And then that freed him to be a little more open and, you know, liberated in what he was writing poetry about. Or maybe it was just the financial success of it that kind of put him on a proper footing where he could then spend the time the way he wanted to spend it, which was writing poetry.
Yeah. And perhaps in the poems, he didn't have to give the kind of details that he gives in Jude the Obscure or Tess of the D'Urbervilles. He could give the feelings without giving the facts.
Yeah. And he did feel like his novels were being misunderstood. And maybe he thought something about the novel requires you, in a sense, to be understood in a way that maybe writing poems doesn't, where there's more room for ambiguity or more, multiple readings or that it's requiring people to make leaps of faith and so on, that novels maybe, or the novels he was writing, didn't have the room for that.
Yeah. And I believe he was also friends with Meredith, wasn't he? And Meredith had his famous sonnet sequence. Am I getting this right? Modern Marriage.
That sounds right.
Which, Hardy must surely have known. So perhaps that, too, was an inspiration, seeing one of his acquaintances or friends turning their personal life into poetry rather than fiction.
Right. Did you say Modern Marriage?
I think it's called Modern Marriage.
Yeah, I'm looking it up. I think it's called Modern Love, which
is
an interesting transposition
totally
for you. Yeah.
I'm sorry. I should have looked it up beforehand.
Well, that's okay. I kind of like the idea that we would kind of collapse the two, because it does seem like in the example of Hardy as well, the difference between marriage and love is quite distinct.
And of course, we were talking about Hardy making mistakes, so it's only appropriate if we make a few mistakes in his honor. I mean, his character's making mistakes, I should say.
Right. Well, when it comes to the History of Literature podcast, as hosted by Jack Wilson, mistakes are never in short supply.
but nor are brilliant insights, wonderful empathy, and exhilarating eloquence.
Okay, well, let's stop there. That's the first time I think I've ever stopped on a high note that referred to myself. So thank you, Margot Livesey. The book is called The Road from Belhaven. Margot Livesey, thank you so much for joining me on the History of Literature.
As always, this was a total pleasure, and I learned so much. Thank you for turning me back to Hardy, and especially for taking me to the poems, which I need to become better acquainted with.
Okay, there we go. Well, don't we all need to become better acquainted with the poetry of Thomas Hardy? That's a good pursuit. Okay, that's going to do it for this episode of The History of Literature. My thanks to Thomas Hardy for destroying himself for literature, both novels and poetry. We won't tell Henry James to stuff it. He is the master, after all. One does not say, cram it, master. Or maybe one does. I don't know. Have you said that before? Maybe you have. I have not. And my thanks to Margot Livesey for helping us to kick off the new 100 episodes with episode number 601. Both Margot's novel, The Road from Belhaven, which I bought my own mother for Mother's Day. Hope she's not listening. But if she is, she'll soon get an unsurprising gift in the mail. In any case, Margot's novel, The Road from Belhaven, is an excellent gift for your mother or your other loved ones or yourself. It's a beautiful book, both inside and out. We will be back with an episode on Emerson soon. And around the corner, we have a Japanese classic novel, a look at mad women and how they've been treated in literature, an episode on Margaret Fuller, a look at some influential bookmakers, and much, much more. I'm Jack Wilson. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time. Thank you.